All right, welcome to the August 24th, 2016 environmental law class. And as always, we begin with a quick look back. We had our first class on Monday, and in that class, we dove into some of the foundational principles of environmental law, the models that drive the way we write our statutes, the way we create our case law. And keep in mind some fundamental points that are going to drive our discussion for the rest of the semester. Number one, and I think this is a fairly non-controversial, non-political statement, it is incontrovertible that current usages of natural resources are unsustainable, particularly in industrialized nations. You may remember in our class, I mentioned that China and India alone, if they were to raise their living standards to the same as Japan's, they would consume the output of the biosphere for that year. Now, whether or not you would agree with the precise contours of that statement, I think that most environmental economists you talk to, most ecologists you talk to, will all say the same thing. If the entire planet rose to industrialized world living standards, we would end up doing irreversible damage to the ecosystem. It would not be sustainable. But balanced with that fundamental premise is the truth that we've already hit the low-hanging fruit. A lot of the worst environmental problems with the most inexpensive solutions have already been performed. I wish some of you could have been here with me when I first came to Houston in the 1980s. I'll tell you that there's been tremendous progress in some environmental problems, but those were the ones where the cost of doing it was far less than the benefit generated. Now we're looking at much more expensive aspects, which we'll talk about today. So those more difficult solutions are going to require certain hallmarks in their solutions. Namely, one, it's going to require collective action by multiple parties. In some cases, like climate change, potentially millions, if not billions, of parties. Number two, it's going to potentially require changes in lifestyles, which politically have been enormously difficult to do. So with those in the background, those fundamental bedrocks of fact, we started talking about some of the precepts of intellectual frameworks to approach environmental issues. And we talked about the big two, namely, one, the idea of an anthropocentric versus a ecologically driven deep ecology model. And then I also talked a little bit about the idea that maybe things could be approached in a rights-based perspective, that natural entities actually may have an entitlement to be treated in a way that preserves their integrity. And that those two concepts may not necessarily work together with each other very neatly, and they certainly conflict if you're going to do a rights-based approach, but you have an anthropocentric approach to law. Meshing the two are going to be extraordinarily difficult to do. We also talked a little bit about ecological approaches and the idea that ecosystems may yield benefits independent of their members, and that sometimes getting that emergent value from a complex system is extraordinarily difficult to attain and assess. And we finished up by talking a little bit about fracking and how those models might approach dealing with that kind of problem. So is everyone's neurons engaged? Y'all remember it now from Monday. Okay, any questions about that? Because we're about to go over to the other side of the fence. I nearly said the dark side, but I didn't. With that in mind, I know y'all told me yesterday on Monday that there are some people with, a background in economics. If I remember right, you did? Who else did? Oh, don't look so resigned.
It's been a while, so I may not be much help.
Look, we are barely going to get above a supply-demand curve today. You're in good shape. And I'm sorry, you too as well?
Yeah.
All right, you're my bench of experts for today. That does not mean I'm calling on you today. Just if you can, jump in, volunteer, correct me, steer me straight, add value where you can. By the way, I'm not calling on anybody in class today since it's our first week. Next week I will start, as we get into the meat of nuisance law, ask some of you to step forward and discuss cases, and I'll have the opt-out sheet for you all at the start of that class. Okay. All right, so with that, today we're going to talk about economic theory in environmental law, approaches to protecting the environment rooted in economics. And I'm going to give away the ending by telling you that economic models are the dominant paradigm in U.S. environmental regulation. We can talk about exceptions. We can talk about, for example, endangered species later in the semester. But meat and potatoes, bread and butter, most environmental issues this day are framed initially by agencies in terms of their economic dimensions. So it's important for us to walk out of class today with at least the basic toolkit on what economic principles we need to have to understand and interpret those decisions. So I'm going to do something with a little bit of risk of insulting your intelligence by talking about economic concepts, which I suspect many of you already know, especially our bench of experts, or alternatively, you may not have realized you know, but they're just such a part of the currency of everyday conversation that we all carry them out. So if I can, let me distill down some of the key principles of what I'll call classical economics, because those are the same principles which drive most environmental regulation now. The first, The first is the concept of rational actors. Homo economicus. The idea is that most economic approaches to solving a problem have built into the premise that the individuals faced with a choice will make the choice rationally in a way that maximizes the value that they carry away from the decision. Bloodless, cold, heartless, cruel. But nonetheless, the presumption is that when faced with an economic decision, the rational actor will choose the most productive decision. Now, I want to put a small asterisk on this, because it ain't necessarily so. There have been enormous strides in studying the actual mental processes underneath economic decisions. And we have discovered that there's a large body of predispositions, blind spots, cognitive flaws in the way that we evaluate risks and values in a way that makes it actually a lot of our decisions are not necessarily entirely rational. Now, leaving aside the fact that that's kind of cool, for those of you interested, I highly recommend a book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Professor Kahneman, which is just fabulous. Why does it matter to us? Why should we care? Well, it turns out that the cognitive blind spots we're talking about are particularly prevalent with environmental issues. For example, the human mind is terrible at evaluating long-term risks. We are awful at balancing large damage loss situations with low probabilities of happening against something that has maybe a higher chance of happening with the smaller stakes. That's why lotteries work. We are also heavily influenced by irrelevant factors, such as how recent something happened to us. We tend to overweight bad things that happened to us recently as opposed to things that happened farther ago. So flag it for you in your notes, put the asterisk there, but for now, when you look at the models used by EPA, if you look at the models used by any other federal agency in most states, they're premised on the idea that rational actor is the valid starting point for most economic analysis. Now, number two, again, classical economics, a free market will lead to the most efficient allocation of resources. Hopefully everyone here in the room is going, yeah, that's sort of built into the fiber of the American psyche at this point. What does that mean when you try to unpack it? And here the waters, especially the theoretical ones, get a little murky. The premise here is that if you have a market where sellers and buyers can freely intermingle with each other, that the way that the market will automatically and magically, with the famous term of the invisible hand, make sure that the person who has the highest value, places the most value in a resource, will get it out of that market, is the concept that the price is actually a way of communicating. By setting a price for a product and being able to sell the market to people who are willing to buy it, that price packages a lot of other subtle factors that you can't get at efficiently in other ways. It's essentially a signal that packages multiple and deeper layers of information. So a lot of things matter when you talk about price. Setting the price right is the premise for a free market yielding the most efficient allocation of resources. I'll pause. The two things I just gave you would normally occupy an entire semester of macroeconomics. So any questions so far or thoughts? Corrections and suggestions? Do they think of it differently in Canada?
Oh, I was just, if you're talking classical economics, no. But rational actors can have other impacts other than just monetary ones.
Okay. Just one in particular, just out of curiosity, because now
I'm just saying, like, generally speaking, I would say that rational actors, you can be rational just because you can't put a monetary, you can place a monetary value on something that someone else can't. Uh-huh. You can still be a rational actor just because someone else thinks that you're not, you know.
So what's an example of something that...
Trying to price the value of clean air or something, right? Like, mm-hmm. if I value that a lot, I'm going to pay more for my electric bill to get it from renewable sources than somebody else would.
Right, so we can all have individual variations in our valuation. Right. Even to the point where there's a disjoint where someone may be thought to be acting irrationally from the perspective of someone else. But yeah, and I'll grant you that. Any other thoughts? All right. Okay. I snuck one by you. Most efficient. Why do we care about the most efficient outcome? What's the virtue of efficiency? Now, that's a huge, steaming, open question, which I leave for you. But the presumption for classical economics for our class today is that this is the desired output. This is the metric you use to measure, bless you, the best result. Is that you, Ellen? Okay, you're allergic to economics, I'll have to remember that. Okay, so third point, last one. What do you need to have a free market that functions properly? Essentially, it needs to be transparent. It needs to be liquid. You need to be able to trade quickly, efficiently, without having a large number of costs associated with doing it. And if you do that, you will naturally lead to the least costly and most efficient allocation of resources through trades. And that's it. No government agencies, no royal fiats, no econometric modeling and five-year plans. The market, according to this model, yields the most efficient allocation of resources magically. And I say that not facetiously. It yields it in such a way it doesn't require active and cognitive, conscious intervention by individuals. Okay. I'm sorry?
I'm just thinking of the perfect example that would be Somalia.
Somalia?
Is what they consider the only example on the planet of an unfettered free market system.
Is that a critique, I hope?
No, that, I don't.
Because I'm not even sure we'll hold that up as a desirable outcome.
That's a critique.
Okay.
Because it's not regulated at all, mm-hmm. and its supply and demand is literally what drives it.
Okay. And since you said it, do you mind if I just segue to supply and demand? And again, important because this influences most environmental legal thought. We're all familiar, I think, with the idea of supply and demand curves. But very basically, we have price and supply. Intuitively, we all know that the more things cost, the less people are going to want them because you don't want to have to pay for them. The cheaper they are, the more likely you are you're going to want them. So if you're going to do a demand curve, if price is high, it would kind of go like, starts here and then it goes down. And then the other intersecting curve is actually going to be your supply curve. What does that mean? It means that actually, if I got these reversed, I do this every year. Somehow I managed to mess up the basics of the curves.
The demand goes down.
All right, so this would be, if price goes up, demand goes down, so this would be demand. And this would be supply. Thank you. See, I knew you guys would be valuable from this. Did you say it or did you? Okay, all right. It could have been you. You could have said it. All right. Isn't political science largely economics?
There's some of it in there.
Okay, all right. Oh, we're not going to chase that one down. All right. I'm sure I'm mangling this somehow. The point is that as price goes up, your demand is going to go down. As your supply increases, the price for that, since you're not competing for it, also decreases. Essentially, what you're supposed to get essentially is the most optimal allocation is when your supply and your demand curves intersect. And this would yield you the optimum price and the optimum output supply. And that if you have something that is in too much supply, it'll move down on the price curve to the point where it becomes more efficient for more people to pitch in and move that back towards a more equilibrium point. You have a situation where the prices are too high, you end up with people jumping in to manufacture more supply to take advantage of that profit, and it pushes it back down. So it tends to settle into a saddle point, a curve equilibrium, and that is the most efficient allocation between price and demand. Now, there's a whole rat's nest of assumptions built around this very basic model. Number one is, what's in the price? Who sets the price? And what does price have to do with environmental values? I'm going to pause here because, again, my secret fear with this class is I'm going to be talking about things you already know. How many of you are familiar with the concept of externalities? Okay, I think, is that virtually unanimous? Some of you are not raising your hands, but I suspect you do anyway. Okay, admit it. All right, then since we all know it, this is a low-risk question. Who would like to describe an externality so I'm not just up here yakking at you for an hour? I won't call on our economics experts because I promised you guys had a free pass today. But anyone else?
Like the unintended...
And I'm sorry, your name again?
Ryan.
Ryan, thank you.
Kind of like the unintended consequences and effects of a transaction, I guess in this case, effects on greater society.
Why are they unintended? And I'm not Socratically torturing you, I'm just curious why you use that particular term.
That's just kind of what I remember from taking college economics, honestly.
Oh, so you're part of the bench too.
Okay. I mean, I took one class.
That's enough. All right.
I gotta be.
Okay, I will give you that's a start, but it opens the door to a deeper question. Why is it unintentional? And why is it a surprise? If you set the price, presumably you know what you're doing.
I think it kind of relates to one considering one's own self-interest over the interest of other valuable things, such as the environment or...
Why would the price cause me not to care about the environment? Because you're getting at the heart of what an externality is.
Well, I was just saying, like, if you have the ability to profit off of something, it kind of can push everything else out of the window.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that, almost. Let's see. You are going to volunteer. Even with a free pass, you're volunteering today. Okay.
Well...
You get extra karma points for the rest of the semester. Remind me.
I'll take them. So an externality, it's, he was saying, a consequence or a cost that's not considered by the supplier when setting price.
Okay.
Because it falls on people outside of the supplier.
So basically, it's a cost that's not packaged in the price.
Yes.
And if I'm making something and I'm setting the price and I don't have to pay for something that I'm using, the market doesn't respond to it. And what's my incentive if I get something for free? That one's easy. Okay, I'll have to demonstrate it here. Catch. Okay. Normally, I'd have to pay a buck to get rid of this. I just got rid of it without paying a cent. You have to pay for it. What am I going to do with my next cup? I might start bringing cups up here by the dozen. It doesn't cost me a thing. An externality is an unpriced aspect of an economic transaction so that the price fails to capture its cost, which causes distortions in market allocation of resources. And I want to be fair, you were exactly right. The classic example of this is environmental. to use. Trash is our example here, and you don't have to keep the cup. I was just kidding.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll throw it away.
There you go. But now I'm out of coffee for the rest of the class. That was a very poorly considered move. With environmental, if I am able to use air and water and land for free, and essentially shift those costs to other people, I will try and draw off a plant here to demonstrate the point. Essentially, I am encouraged, I'm incentivized, I am motivated by the free market system to misuse those resources, to burn through them, to not pay regard to the cost I'm inflicting on other parties. So externality is really the foundational concept that drives classical models of economics of dealing with environmental issues. All clear so far? And hopefully that this is relatively familiar to some of you at this point. Okay? All right, so that gets us to the next question. Yeah. So what? How do you deal with externalities? What are the tools in the table that make sense? So offhand, if I'm throwing a cup, what are the ways to make me stop doing in the future to prevent that externality from occurring?
Charge you.
In what way?
For littering, for giving your cup.
So the state fines me for throwing that away. Is there any other way to do it?
You build it into the price of the cup initially, somehow.
Ooh, I kind of like that. Kind of like a take-back law. That's an elegant, sophisticated answer for a very basic question. I like that. Did everyone hear what she said? You build into the price the disposal cost. Does that essentially make me liable for the cost of disposal up front and the price I have to set for my own product? So it's really a polluter pays principle. You internalize it by making me bear that cost. The other way to do it would be to give you a right to charge me for it. I can't put my cup on top of your computer unless I pay you 50 cents for it. Okay? Does that make sense for everyone so far? Is that the only answer, making me pay for it?
Do what Japan does with Mount Fuji, and they pay citizens.
I've never got that answer before.
I've been there,
okay.
Unfortunately. But they pay their citizens to go through every weekend and pick up trash, and whatever they collect, the government pays them money by the pound.
That's another way to internalize it, by giving someone a profit motive to basically deal with the problem. Same thing as with, you know, the plastic bottle. You're my perfect example for today. The plastic bottle. A lot of the, you have take-back laws, which are glass for plastic bottles, where you get money when you bring them back. But is there anything else? Yes, Allie?
Putting an injunction, you just got to stop whatever you were doing that made you throw that cup.
Isn't that sort of the flip side of saying he can charge me for putting it on there? If I don't pay him what he asks, he can go to court and enforce it.
Sure, but you might not recover anything in that scenario, but you'd still have to stop.
That's true. Injunctive relief usually, though, is packed with the concept of a property right, which makes me person is liable for paying for that cost. But you're absolutely correct. And next week is all about injunctions. Be ready. Okay? There's an alternative one that doesn't seem fair, but it works. Remember, rational actor, cold, heartless, cruel. You don't care about justice. You care about efficiency.
You don't have to pay anything. It's just the most efficient thing that you threw that cup.
Well, then it would be an externality. It'd be the right market answer. The idea here is that this is an unpriced variable that causes an overconsumption of something that should be included. What do you mean?
What?
I'm sorry, what they're willing to pay who?
They're willing to pay
this. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble. This is, I'm worried you're either speaking softly or is this the first creeping signs that I'm actually getting older, which
no,
I refuse to admit.
It's me.
Okay. Who's paying whom? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Am I paying him or is he paying me? You can barely control yourself, I can tell. Come on, it's all right. No? All right, she's reconsidering. I think you've got the right answer. That's why I was trying to give you credit for it and let the light of glory shine on you in the back of the room.
Well, it's fading.
But you're exactly right. Instead of me paying him for the right to put my cup on his desk, if you really hate it, it pisses you off, you just don't want it, you pay me not to do it. And in theory, you can internalize that externality through a beneficiary pay system. According to the market, which with an important caveat we'll come to in a minute called the Coase theorem, you get to the same place. As far as the market contributors, they are exactly equivalent mathematically. So you can have polluter pays or beneficiary pays, and environmental law has both. The overwhelming most commonly used paradigm is polluter pays, but there are instances where the beneficiaries can pay for environmental benefits. One example I'll give you right now is the idea of a conservation easement, which we'll talk about later in the semester. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk about, it's so obvious, why doesn't this just happen naturally? What are the barriers to internalizing these costs? What are the reasons we can't just let it happen naturally? And with that in mind, what I'd like to do is to flesh out this concept we've been talking about of polluter pay versus beneficiary pays and why things may come to different answers by collecting some data. I'd like to actually do, if I can, a classroom laboratory experiment. And I've not done this before, so if it gets into a spectacular crash and burn, well, I'll laugh about it and I'll buy everyone a glass of beer later this semester. But what I'd like to do is have two groups of volunteers. The first one, each of five, preferably from different sides of the room. So just, can I ask you five to be my first volunteers? Okay. And then I guess you five will be my second group of volunteers. Here's our premise. For our first group of volunteers, who of you has a business background or wants to be in business? Okay, you are an industrialist now. You have a company called Longhorn Chemical. We're going to keep this as simple and brutally basic as we possibly can, because I'm going to do something to you in a minute that's going to be pretty time pressure, and I want to get all the extra stuff off the table. You have a chemical plant somewhere in Central Texas, and what you want to do is you want to change and do a remodeling of it that is going to make it produce more. And here are the only things you need to know. The cost of doing it is $100,000. By doing it, your benefit, the amount of additional materials that you're able to make, it's going to kick up by $200,000. All clear so far? Okay, so I couldn't tell. Did you volunteer as well? Yeah. So, I'm sorry, your name was?
Mary.
So you five, sorry, four. We had a group of five, so you four, you're still in the economic bench. You're safe. You're not on this one. You own houses next to this factory. All of your houses have the same value. $500,000. It's a hill country. It's beautiful. He has very nice houses. You love going and sitting, sipping, you know, microbrew ale on your back porch, watching the limestone cavern springs bubble up in your backyard. If Longhorn Chemical goes ahead with its project, you're going to lose 10% of the value of your homes. $50,000 each. All clear so far? Okay. Any questions for the rest of the room? All right, so with that in mind.
I have one question.
Yes.
Is the 200K annually, or what's the benefit? What is that on?
That's interesting, because usually when I talk about this theoretically, that question comes up after everyone's had a car crash trying to figure it out.
Oh.
So the short answer is, it depends. For now, we're just going to do it a one-time benefit, but you're absolutely correct. It could be every year. So how do you value that future income stream in the current transaction? And for that, hold me to my word, keep me honest. Let's talk about discount rates after we're done with this example, okay? All right, so just to kind of make sure we're all doing this legit, here's your card, here's your values. There you go. I'm going to put you in a speed negotiation round. No rules, no format, no requirements. You can guys can do it however you want to. The only rule is this is a polluter pays. He has to pay you to get your permission to build his plant expansion. You have 5 minutes to work out whether or not you guys are going to give him approval to do it and how much he's going to have to pay you and what that number is. Rebecca?
Does he need unanimous approval?
Well, does that matter? Yes. Let's say for now he needs unanimous approval. But I will ask you to revisit and think through with me what happens if he only needs, say, two of you out of the four. It creates a different dynamic, doesn't it? Okay, so ready, set, by 3:15, I need an answer from you guys. And you guys can collaborate, you can talk separately, you can do it by email. I don't care. You can go in the hallway and throw dice. It's up to you. All I need is an answer in 5 minutes. Now, my group over here, who wants to be the industrialist?
What's your say? Why do you say different more than mine?
You know that you do.
Mine doesn't have any role.
Really? And I was up with your ACLU laptop. I thought for sure you're going to lead the group in opposition to this plant expansion.
Okay. You guys have exactly the same.
It's going to be 10,000 or 10% reduction.
Right? Except you do not have food or pay. You
have cost him $100,000 and he's going to benefit of $200,000.
Now, you guys can collaborate, you can cooperate, you can hit each other. I don't care. But by the same time, in 5 minutes, I need your number that you talk with. Now, that can be each of you tell me separately what your number is. You could deal with them collectively.
Okay,
it's
so
up to you what you want to do.
This would work, but
you, yeah, you hold the benefit, they have to persuade you. Maybe so, to a certain extent, you can call the shots here. But you have 4 minutes to do it.
Maybe, I don't know, whatever percent you can okay, so do. Whatever BIOS thinks.
You get $200K profit,
$100K. We want to
work. Our homes are worth $500K.
Well, the profit's
$100K.
Yeah. You guys down
with profits for the industrial?
Yeah. Because I lose $100,000.
Yeah.
I mean, this is pretty bad for us.
And the pollution.
Right. So he's benefiting a lot more than putting in financial deals.
So yeah, if this is.
And one of you can be a holdout if you want. That's why I put that at the bottom.
Yeah, it says let your neighbors pay as
much as possible. Right off the bat.
Pick up what's left.
Right off the bat.
And then make.
Ever.
Okay.
No,
they're setting you as
your collective
action. So,
yeah,
you can be like, yeah,
so I was thinking
like free rides.
Yeah,
free rides.
Yeah,
I'll be the
okay. While they're doing that, guys, I thought I'd get into the spirit of this class. How many of you have seen this before? It is fascinating. It is monopoly for natural resources. So,
in addition to having endangered whales as your little totem that goes around the bar,
there's 5,000 each year. If it were per year.
Give a negative ad campaign about your
crime. And then so it's $50,000 reduction. So,
you know what?
That is what they consider to be valuable property that you would end up on the market.
Well, that's the word. I take a $50K loss right off the bat. Someone, we're still taking a risk, assuming that your business is going to have a community.
I make less money than you.
In order to reach Pareto, 100% of the damages, decision, plus the 10% we're giving up the profits, each of the money goes game, so that our homes would not
be the same.
So we all get our money,
and therefore you'd be equal in
So your pay and your loss.
But then why would we do that?
Assuming
that this is not one of our power, I don't know if he says it's a one-time deal or
you have problems. Like, how do you ensure your neighbors?
We want our actual neighbors. So each of us is going to lose $50,000.
We're going to talk about it.
So you're today. And then
you would definitely be on a loyalty one.
Yeah, you would definitely be like an HOA.
Yeah,
yeah.
Is it like a yes no thing, like do you like half of it and our home value and some of it? You know, like is it a linear?
Again, so that will be 10% for all four. So that's
as soon as you initiate her program or whatever, like our house is automatically.
Yeah. Okay, 1 minute.
Like
1 minute left.
$200,000.
Yeah, no,
but she's not spending.
Her net gain.
But yeah, she has possible. He said you would miss out on the stream.
No, no, I know that. But you have to incentivize her not.
But that's going to be why into that. That's where you pay more completely. Because then it didn't have to pay up automatically.
If she doesn't commit, she doesn't get the $200,000.
$50,000 decrease.
$26,000 each. All right, we'll give you 26,000 times 4.
So we want more fishes.
That's the deal.
Here you go, you can pass the word out to
okay. Do you have the animal encounters cards too?
No, I think that's fine.
There's global exploration ones and animal. Oh yeah, there's both.
Once a year, like something like that, once a year.
She has to pollute.
Yeah, right now, it's only a one-time benefit.
Right now.
Okay.
If you'd like, you could also get what you think the answer is going to be. You don't want to play. Annualized screen. Write down your answer.
Yeah. So since it's a one-time,
if it's one-time.
Then you'd accept the 26,000 each.
So what, you guys want to include that also here?
Yeah.
But I mean, we're not already going to make 50,000.
You're not going to know how much
the charge is.
No.
And then let's include that
here. No, we'll write
that.
One time.
I know. You guys are with that, like once a year.
That would be very different.
No. Not even if we give you 50,000.
Yeah, because that's going to be great.
Yeah. We're like, okay,
that's
going to
be some chair.
We're selling a house.
Yeah, oh yeah. I'm moving. Yeah.
That keeps our beer tasting good.
Right, yeah. My only experience with economics is that you can't even touch your thing
about it. Automatically easy.
Just a very angry man.
The thing with political science and economics is we do all like this theory.
Decision
like,
theory.
Applied stuff. We do like Hayek and all of the like.
Yeah.
Oh no, we did all the theory.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's like, I took like so many classes.
I found out Tammy got a couple of pages from the road to
surf cross sword,
that would just give me so much information.
See, I would like it, but I don't think a lot of people would.
Where'd you get your undergrad?
University of St. Thomas.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Okay, Henry, you got it worked out?
So you're not going to get a discount for that?
Hey, you know, take the paperweight for me. It's supposed to be 5 minutes. Got to cut rough
justice.
Sitting in four homeowners to get to the
most run down the back.
That's
it? Yeah, that's what they offered me for the return.
Are you for the
return? Yes, I accepted.
Yeah, okay. In the real world, I'd ask all of you guys to sign it. But for now, we're just going to stick with what we have.
I'll sign it.
All right.
2 years.
All right, time is up. Quick check. Is my Monopoly set completely dispersed now? Has everyone had a chance to look at it? Maybe you guys have been playing back there.
The cards are really interesting. You can buy Siberia.
Okay. All right. Now, I am going to ask the rest of the class to do something where it's very important in economics. There have to be stakes to actually have a valid outcome. So I actually have something that's a little valuable. This is a lapel button from a group called Earth First. I got in the basement of a Berkeley secondhand bookstore in 1988, and to my knowledge, I've never seen another one. This was a group that was famous for chaining itself to redwood trees and spiking old growth forest and ultimately escalating to arson, fire, and sabotage. They were considered Earth First, all else is secondary. So this is a terrorist button. That's unfair. A lot of the originators were actually very good people, but some of the later folks who got attracted were a little off the reservation. So the person who got the better deal gets the button. And I'll let you guys vote to decide, okay? So with that in mind, what did you end up with, Henry?
Okay, so we end up with 10%.
Here, keep in mind.
That one's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, wrong one. Here you go. All right, before he starts to describe, I have to warn you, the word royalty shows up twice in this answer. So I'm not sure how we're going to make this one work.
Okay, so no, we disregard the first one. So everything right is from the third line.
Okay.
Yeah, so what we agree was 10% royalty split among the four homes owner.
What is the royalty on?
So the royalty on, it's on the 200,000.
On the benefit.
On the benefit.
Profits. So a 10% royalty on a $200,000 profit means you're paying each of them $20,000.
Yes.
Split on four, so each of us get 5,000.
So he's paying you $5,000 for the, oh, I'm sorry.
Annually or whatever it would be.
So $5,000 each. Remember, I said it was a one-time payment.
Okay, well, that's why we include the provision that the initial payment of each person for the reduction in home value at $50,000 each.
Right.
Okay, so this is above
a $50,000.
This.
Yeah.
So for the first year, it's $55,000, no matter what.
Per house, yes.
Per house. So you are opening your checkbook and paying them $220,000.
Right.
Okay. Which is more than the benefit of your one-time expansion.
Right.
Why?
Yes.
I'm serious. What led you to agree to that?
Well, because my benefit is not. It's going to be long term.
So your presumption is a long term benefit, and that you'll recover your difference here.
Right.
Over the next 10 years, paying out the 10% royalty?
Yes.
Okay. Would you have a different answer if it was a one-year thing?
Yes, I would.
What would your answer be?
Maybe not give them up to that amount.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would you just take off the $5,000 or just pay them 50? In other words, you'll just pay them the reduction in the value of their houses, but you're not going to pay them an additional amount?
Yes.
Okay, so this would be your one-year default. Okay, so this is polluter pays. This is homeowner pays. What do we have for you?
Okay.
What's your royalty interest?
Oh, our deal was much less sophisticated.
I'm sorry, here you go.
The homeowners created an association amongst themselves. And
what happened to the rational actors looking for your own benefit at the expense of your competitors?
Oh, you got to stop the free riders.
Oh, man.
There was some social little.
Now I know who the monopolist is in the classroom. Okay.
So they each decided to offer me $26,000 per homeowner. This is under the assumption that I was standing to gain 100 after this 100 loss.
That's right.
For 1 year.
Okay.
So if it's a one-time deal, I stand to make $104,000 not to pollute.
So that's $104,000 times 4.
26 times 4.
$26,000
yes.
Times 4.
You guys?
It's 104.
One of four. Okay, just want to be sure. And this is a one-time deal. That
yes,
means that
so that I make more than 100.
You do, except remember, your actual profit is the difference between these two.
Yes, 100.
So you're 6,000 in the hole.
Wow. She's getting 104,000 from us.
Oh, it's the other way around.
They're paying me.
Okay, so your benefit is you get 4K. I'm sorry. I got my polarities flipped. Okay, so you're getting a little bit, more importantly, you're getting your expansion.
Yes.
And you are getting your expansion, but you're paying 220K, which would be on top of the 100K you're paying to expand your facility. So per house, it's a rather different outcome. Okay.
Wait, I thought they were paying her the
not.
Yeah, she
doesn't
get
not
the
doing
expansion.
It.
So basically she's making $104,000
without. Instead of the $100 that I would make.
I misunderstood what you were saying.
No, I don't make an extra. I make the one more. That's it.
Okay. It's you would be making that. All right, so make sure. You are paying them to be able to do it. They agreed to do it, so you're paying $220,000 on top of your $100,000, but you get your benefit. So effectively, you're out of pocket.
Like $120,000
or something.
$120,000,
okay. All right, so that's a little better.
But he's down $120,000.
Yes. But the numbers are at least looking similar.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay,
I'm plus.
No, we're plus.
That's a plus.
Sorry.
I make plus.
All right.
200.
Okay. Thank you so much. Before I let you guys go away, who, in the rest of the opinion of the non-participators, had the better deal at the end of the day? Priya for being paid not to do it, or these guys, he gets to build his plant, but he's paying a fairly substantial sum to the homeowners.
I think those homeowners over there got the best deal.
Why, Allie?
Because they've got up 55K, and if it's just for short term, mm-hmm. and they're like long term, it might be even more.
Okay. But isn't that a function of the fact that the right to consent reside with them as opposed to her? So they clearly were better from the very beginning. They were just trying to negotiate what the amount was. I'm asking who negotiated the better deal given this, the deal that they were given in the first place.
Regarding the business.
Right, between the two, which of the Longhorn Chemicals struck the better deal as a matter of negotiation?
I mean,
no, I'm not asking just you, everybody. All right, quick show of hands because we need to finish up. Priya? Hesitant? All right. Henry? No, you can't vote, Patrick.
And we're presuming short term, right? Like this
yes.
Is one-year,
this
yes.
is a one-year deal.
One-year deal.
Okay. All right. Because I have to give this to someone, otherwise I get to keep it, and it's just, I feel guilty. All right. Really? So the rest of you just can't decide, huh? All right. Well, do you feel like you've accomplished it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, right. One vote extra.
My strong advice, do not wear this at job interviews.
Okay.
Do not wear this at your Senate confirmation hearing. And never tell the FBI, NSA, or anyone else that you actually own it. But okay. It's really cool to have.
It is really cool. Earth okay. First, you guys.
You can wear it to the final exam if you want to.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Do you want to see it? Do you want to see it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Actually, if you want to pass it around.
Yeah.
Okay.
What was the point of all this? Notice even though the polarities were different, the numbers roughly ended up not too far apart. What I wanted to do is highlight and see if experimentally we could verify something. Namely, that there are a couple of foundational principles that interplay with the application of what I'll call classical economics to environmental issues that play an important role. One is the concept of transaction cost. The idea that it costs to negotiate, to convene the parties, to take the time to work it out. Here, Henry had the luxury of being the one decider. He was able to sit down, get the information from the other homeowners, and he actually made the call. Here, theoretically, you had four quarreling homeowners who were going to have to reach a resolution until Art reached the monopolistic solution of forcing a monopoly on everybody, which was an elegant solution, I will grant that to you, but it's not classical economics. I guess, actually, it is classical economics. It's not,
just political theory.
But it's not a desired free market outcome, I'll put it that way. So transaction costs play a pivotal role. Why? Because according to a principle that's very famous, known as the Coase theorem, Ronald Coase designed this theory, which basically says that
polluter pays versus beneficiary pays doesn't make a difference if there are no transaction costs. That if it's a frictionless market, and it's just as easy for my four squabbling homeowners to get together and put together their package deal, as opposed to Henry working in solitary splendor with the sole holder of power, you get economically to the same place in terms of the market distribution. You should theoretically end up at the same number, even though the money's going to a different party. The value the market places on the good being produced should be the same. So if you think about that, it means a couple of important concepts. Number one, transaction costs matter enormously. Environmental law, in many respects, is how to craft laws that overcome the inherent transaction costs that are factored and woven into our traditional legal system. Next week, we're going to talk about nuisance law, negligence law, how they apply to environmental issues, and we'll see that those transaction costs are overwhelming in terms of assembling plaintiffs, building a case, proving causation, and collecting a judgment. The other thing that Coase theorem says is that it's not necessarily automatic that the polluter has to pay from an economist's perspective. Now, I only mention that because most environmental lawyers you talk to, that is not the default assumption. Almost every U.S. environmental law and regulation is rooted in the concept that the polluter pays as the most efficient way to internalize those externalities. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that the free market can't find other answers if you can solve the transaction cost conundrum. And some of the most creative and innovative work taking place right now is finding ways to put a value on certain environmental goods that are currently not priced in the market so that they can become subject to these market forces and distributions. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but think about what the value is of the things we get for free currently. Clean air, drinkable water. Those are things that normally take an enormous amount of economic and industrial and technological resources to create if you're going to do it through man's efforts. Sorry, sexist language. Human efforts. But nature gives it for us for free.
Have you seen, I mean, you have a lot of experience in environmental law, so have you seen that dynamically change with water when we started selling bottled water where that wasn't a thing 20 years ago? Has that been able to help the dynamic of putting a price on clean water?
Not really, because most water right now, and by the way, I'm going to weasel on you as soon as I give you an answer.
That's fine.
Is viewed as a luxury good. Yeah. People buy the water because there's a certain cachet from getting from a certain location.
True.
There's not oftentimes a real quality difference at all. And I'm sure most of you know the secret that a lot of the bottled water you buy is actually city water that's been repackaged in plastic bottles with a nice label. Now, there is a distinction. Other markets, that's not true. I spent part of the summer in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, and every street corner, especially towards the more desolated parts of the town of the earthquake, you will see piles, mounds of plastic, which I had no clue, it looks like snowdrifts, clear blue film. And I basically said, what's this? Turns out there's no water to drink in Port-au-Prince. There's no public drinking water system. So what's happened is that the people are standing on street corners and selling small little Culligan water packets of safe water to drink. So in that sense, yes, there is a market system valuing the water, handing it out at a low cost. But I think the more interesting question, to take your question and permutate it a little bit, is not bottled water. It's how do we price the water we get from our tap? And I'm sure most of you know that we get our water drastically less than what we actually have to justify in terms of economic cost. It's heavily subsidized. So to a certain extent, there's a bit of a market failure, but at the same time, you could also say it's part of just a basic right. Everyone should have an access to that water for an affordable price. But I'll stop there. You could go a whole semester about water pricing. It's really interesting. Okay, any other questions or thoughts? Okay, so I've been talking about transaction costs, misallocations, ways to internalize them, pollution pay versus beneficiary pays, and the Coase theorem. Let me add another very important concept to the economic mix for environmental law purposes, which is the notion of tragedy of the commons. Now, again, I'm going to pause to benchmark my audience here. How many of you are familiar with the concept of the tragedy of the commons? Wow. From where? That's no fun. It stole my thunder. It would have been so much fun to get into that. Okay. Then consider this a quick micro review. I'm going to expect you guys all know it down to the fiber of your beings because it will be somewhere in your bar review class at some point in the future. Notion of the tragedy of the commons is that if you have a commonly owned resource shared by multiple parties and none of them bear the cost of placing additional demands on that resource, that unstable economic configuration will result in the depletion of that resource. Translate that into English. The most common example, say, what can I erase here? I assume everyone's familiar now with the concepts, the principles of economic, classical economics. The example that Hardin used, and it's kind of become the default for this, is a pasture. Grass. Everyone has the right to use the pasture. So there's an entire village nearby where everyone brings their cows to graze. Everyone has 10 cows. So let's assume we have 5 people who graze their cows. We've got 50 cows that graze. Okay. Now, suppose I'm one of those 5. My choice is I'd like to add another cow to my 10. So, from my perspective, does it cost me anything extra to put the cow on there? No. From a rational economic actor perspective, I have every reason to add my cow. I get something from it, namely that cow's output. Milk, meat, cheese. At much reduced cost, because that cost is split with everybody else who shares the pasture. So the cost is always less than the benefit to me. So all perfect sense, we're going to have magically another cow appear the next day. Here's the catch. 2, 3, 4, and 5, all the other owners have exactly the same economic rationale. They all could add cows too. They get the benefit from it. They don't have to carry the full cost of it. So instead of one cow, you get 5 cows the next morning, and then 10, and then 20. And as a result, absent some type of moderating mechanism to ensure that the cost is more reflective to the shared ownership value, collapse. You end up overgrazing. Now, I know this sounds a bit abstract, it sounds a bit ridiculous, you know, probably picturing polka cows sitting somewhere in a virtual field somewhere. It happens. I've seen it happen. Fisheries collapse because they get overfished, because everyone can fish from the same area. They get the fish, they don't care about the long, I shouldn't say that. It's relatively abstract to them, the long-term health of the fishery, as long as they're getting a catch today. I've seen collapses of grasslands in the West because they get overgrazed by federal leaseholders who have the ability to add cows to their lease. So the tragedy of the commons is considered to be a classic market dysfunction that justifies the use of environmental law to regulate the operation of the normally free market. And usually, that can be either through several mechanisms. One is to regulate access to the field. Another is to actually grant ownership rights to the use of that common resource. Permits to graze that you have to buy so that everyone has a shared economic interest in not overusing the asset. All clear so far? So with that all in mind, I'll simply say in passing, just because we have the minute or so, normally I would love to take some time with you and talk about the prisoner's dilemma. Have you guys had exposure to that already? Is that also in property? No, you guys just know it? This is going to be, I have to run fast to keep ahead of you guys. All right. I'll simply say the tragedy of the commons is simply a specific version of the prisoner's dilemma, or vice versa. The prisoner's dilemma is where you have two conspirators who committed a crime together, you put them in two separate rooms, the police offer them both the same deal, If you rat on your friend, you get a reduced sentence. Your friend will get the full sentence. Well, each of them individually thinks the same thing, which is, well, if I rat on my friend, I'm guaranteed a reduced sentence. If I don't rat, I'm facing a potential full sentence. So the economic incentive for them is to rat. But the fact is, if they both stay silent, none of them get convicted. As a result, the individual economic actor's decision is totally rational. But the collective result is economically deficient. That same dynamic plays a common role with almost all environmental commons allocation issues. And I'll simply say game theory and prisoner's dilemma are actually used in very numerous settings in environmental law.